Radio, Public Radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Starlex Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre, right by Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to my listeners in Preston, South America, and all over the world. Tonight we have an interview with Judy, who will be talking about all things astrology. And we also have an interview with Whitebeard, who will be talking about Halloween and its origins within the Druidic and Pagan faiths. Druidic, I think. We have features from Anthea, who talks to Dave Napier about Honestfield Cemetery, and Tony, who talks to Reverend Jeff Eales about Halloween. Malcolm Grieve reads There Was a Man Dwelt by a Churchyard by M.R. James. A very spooky story, just in time for Halloween. Also, Jeff Sparks is here with the What's On Guide, and we have a tune by Spinal Tap. I'm John Peters Coleman, and in the studio with me now is Judy. Good evening.
Hello there.
So, you are an astrologer.
I am.
Okay, yes. Are you qualified in this?
I am, yes. I have a diploma from the Bristol School of Astrology. I've been actually studying astrology for about, well over 30 years now. But got my diploma from the school about 5 or 6 years ago now.
Okay, so in what ways do you practice this as a practitioner? Do you supply services to people or write columns?
I did write a column a while ago in one of the local papers, which was actually a sort of agony aunt column. But basically, the people that I enjoy doing astrology for are people that come to me as wanting to have their personal chart done for them.
Right.
Either they just think it's a lot of fun, or they've actually got a problem that they want to try and sort out.
Okay, right. I mean, I suppose the most obvious question, which I should ask you first, I mean, I when I chatted to you before, you said that astrology was in fact the first science. I mean, how objective and scientific really is astrology? I mean, what use is it?
Well, objective, that's a good question. A lot of people would say in no way is it a science, and in fact I would probably agree with that and say it's the interpretation of a science. Astrology is actually the interpretation of astronomy, in that an astrological chart is a map of the heavens at the exact time of somebody's birth. So in order to do a chart for someone, you really do need as an exact a time of birth as possible. And then with the aid of all the data that NASA, I think, provide for Raphael's ephemeris, which is where the astrological data is,
You
draw up a chart, and the sign, the constellation coming up on the eastern horizon, is the sort of pivot of the person's chart.
So this is the sun sign, yeah? Which you're talking
about. No, the sun sign is the one that nearly everybody knows.
Yep.
They call it their star sign or their sun sign. The sun is, of course, a star. So, and most people know what that is. But their astrological chart is so much more complex than that.
So what a lot of use is your average Jonathan Kaner or Justin Toper kind of column, which gives you your sun sign? I mean, is that just a very simplified version of what...
It is a very simplified version because, of course, it's dividing the population into 12 different types.
Yes.
And that really isn't enough. And if you were actually going to an astrologer to get your chart done, it is sort of honed to your own specification because it's to do with your time and place.
I mean, aren't people likely just to read into whatever you tell them? You know, they're going to be looking for things, they've come to you, so that they want to read into it. I mean, oh, yeah, brilliant, that's just like me, but it might could say that to anyone, surely.
Absolutely, it's a very good question, and, this is one of the things that astrology has to sort of fight against that theory or that thought. But I'm a great believer in the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and a lot of people are absolutely astounded when you do a chart for them. As to how accurate it is, despite the fact that what you're suggesting is that we can all sort of say, oh, yes, that sounds like me.
Mm.
But there are certain characteristics that in no way are like the person that you're doing a chart for.
Give me an example of a sort of characteristic you might say to someone like...
Well, all right, somebody who's a Cancerian, for instance,
is... Oh, I'm a Cancerian.
Well, so am I. You would, unless they've got, for instance, the sign of Aries in their makeup, mm-hmm. I don't think that a Cancerian would particularly identify with an Aryan who's one of their characteristics is that they're very assertive and sort of gung-ho, yeah. And like to instigate things, mm. And quite sort of, you know, what they know that they are right. That has its very good side as well. There's two sides to every coin, obviously.
Yeah. Hitler was an Aries.
No, I think he was a Taurian.
Oh, was he? Oh, all
with
right.
An
so
Aries
really
moon.
Nice.
I think so. Yeah. I could be proved wrong.
Is it true that in World War II, astrology was used to predict what Hitler would attack and when?
I don't know that. I don't know that. I know that astrology has been used for thousands of years, but yes. I really, that's something I don't know about.
What would you say, I mean, there are a lot of people online who, even people sort of like Jonathan Kaner, for example, from what I can make out, what they basically do when you apply for a personality profile is it's kind of like a complicated computerised thing.
Yes.
And somebody somewhere in an office sort of taps some buttons and they just prints them off and posts it off. Is that any good?
I don't think so, because you can't synthesise it properly. You get all the components, mm-hmm. but they're not sort of knitted in together, which is where the art of the astrologer comes in.
Right. There's another interesting conundrum. We've discovered a new planet in recent years, the 10th planet. Astrologers have been trying to work out what characteristics that means and how that affects people's birth chart. I mean, it's so far away, it's like...
Which planet are you talking about?
Chiron, I believe, isn't it? Isn't it the tenth planet? Right on the outskirts, like way beyond Pluto somewhere. I mean,
right.
Is that of any use?
Well, it's not something that comes into my particular astrological orbit, yeah. But I do continue, like most astrologers, to use Pluto, which has now been relegated to a planetoid. Yeah. I think, but it's. I find it a very important planet when I'm looking at people's charts, and so astrologers do keep it in. And I think I heard recently that they're considering bringing it back, calling it a planet again.
So, I mean, if there is this new tenth planet out there that's been discovered, surely that means that all the astrological charts have been missing something, and that this new planet has its own important characteristics, surely?
Very possibly, but that's happened all along the way. I haven't got my dates on me, but I know that Pluto, Neptune, Uranus are all relatively recently discovered, and charts used to only go up until up to Jupiter and Saturn. In fact, the old orreries, or even the modern models of orreries, which are, in fact, a mechanical model, yep. of the solar system, they generally only go up until Saturn. So we're constantly learning. There are asteroids, there are centaurs, and all sorts of other things that actually come into an astrological chart.
Right. Now, for example, as a practitioner, you say people come to you sometimes for fun, but also for more serious things. They're looking for answers. These could involve sort of life decisions. I mean, you must be quite confident of your skills, of your potentially offering advice to someone about what they should do.
I'm not offering advice to anybody.
So what are you offering? What you're
hopefully offering is giving the person who's come to see you the wherewithal to make their own decisions, to understand themselves a bit more. You're looking at their potential, you're looking at the less positive things. You're just basically giving them the tools to make their own decisions. In no way are you giving them advice. Yeah. So you're very, you have to be extremely careful of how you treat somebody that's coming to see you, because it is, you know, suggesting that some people are extremely vulnerable. So that you really, I mean, hopefully the idea is for them to leave the astrologer feeling far more positive, with a constructive sort of viewpoint, where they're just feeling somewhat more uplifted than when they arrived.
Is it a sort of like a self-governing sort of industry? Is there any body that says, you know, you're sort of like an approved sort of astrologer, or you're not? I mean, anybody could just say, well, I'm an astrologer, I've come around to...
Yes, I mean, there are lots of organisations and lots of schools that... sort of put out astrologers who are properly trained. There's Oh, there's the Faculty of Astrological Studies, the Centre for Psychological Astrology, and all those people. You have to sign some sort of thing before you're really able to practice. And if anybody's going to go to an astrology, you basically want to make sure that they do have some sort of qualification.
Mm. So what are you, how are you passing on your joy of astrology to other people? Are you trying to encourage? I mean, I understand you said there was a Bristol School of Astrology. Are you there?
There is a Bristol School of Astrology, which was where I got my diploma. I don't think they're actually doing diploma courses anymore, but they have three different classes. There's the beginner's class, which I've in fact just started to teach myself, trying to pass on what knowledge I have and enthuse people to, you know, to find out more and keep involved. Mm. And then there's an intermediate level, and then there's a more advanced one where actually people have been keeping going to the advanced one for years, even though they've been doing astrology for some time.
Yeah.
Because you never stop learning, basically.
Okay.
Never stop learning.
Well, thank you very much for coming in today, Judy, and best of luck in your astrological adventures.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
We now have an interview by Anthea where she ventures into Arnosvale Cemetery and talks to friend of Arnosvale Cemetery and heritage tour guide, Dave Napier.
Napier, and I'm a friend of Arnosvale Cemetery, and I've been doing voluntary work here for about 4 years now. And one of the things I do is coordinate the heritage tours around the cemetery.
We're standing right in the middle of the cemetery now.
We're just to the left of the Anglican Chapel, which, as you can see, is quite an imposing building. They're still working on it, part of the restoration work that's been going on over the last year. It's all due to the fact that we were successful in getting a lottery grant of £4.8 million a few years ago, which we're now spending, or have spent. It's not enough, we need a lot more, but it's certainly enabled us to get this place back to something like it was meant to be when it was first envisaged back in the 1830s.
We've just passed a really overgrown area full of brambles and hidden graves. Why did it get into such a derelict state?
It's a long story. The cemetery was very successful through the Victorian period and right into the Edwardian period, but gradually it became full up. There are now over 170,000 people buried here. So basically there was no more room to bury people in any great number. And then in 1929, They started a crematorium, which also did good business. Because you've got to remember, this place was a business. It wasn't ever run by the council.
Oh, was it privately owned then?
It was privately owned right from the start, and one of the main reasons for its inception was to make a profit. The problem was that, as I said, the place became full. They introduced the idea of a crematorium, which was very popular through the 1930s and 40s and 50s and so on, but then there was competition from other more modern installations in the area, and the place went downhill. It became bankrupt, and then began this long period of decay that we're now seeing the results of now.
Who was it owned by? Do you know?
Well, it was owned by a company, the Bristol General Cemetery Company. It was owned by a group of investors, but it was then taken over by a speculator who wanted to develop part of the cemetery for housing. And it was when that news came out that the people of Bristol got interested in the place again and said, oh no, you're not going to do that. And with the support of the council and the local paper, the Evening Post, they were brilliant. Basically, the campaign to save the cemetery won the day. The speculator was stopped from building his houses. And Bristol Council then took over the cemetery, and it's now run on behalf of the council by a trust. The area in front of us here was a rubbish tip, being used as a rubbish tip for many years by that chapel I was talking about, who owned the cemetery for a period of time. We knew there were graves underneath it, but we didn't know who they were. So some of the volunteers got together and gradually cleared off all the rubbish. There are tons of it here. And began to uncover these stones. And it's interesting because they are some of the earliest burials in the Anglican part of the cemetery. And this one in front of us here is in fact the second Anglican burial, which took place in 1840.
When was the cemetery open?
Well, it was open for business in 1839. Perhaps I should explain that there are two groups of important Christians to consider in cemeteries like this. You've got on one side, you've got Anglicans, Church of England, and on the other side, you've got nonconformists. That's to say, people like Baptists and Methodists and Congregationalists and so on. And they had quite different views about Christianity and, more to the point, how they would depart, and their forms of worship were different. So it was important to have two chapels in a cemetery like this, one for the Anglicans, which we're standing in front of, and one for the nonconformists. Also, they would want to be buried in different parts of the cemetery. So you'd have consecrated ground for the Anglicans, and that is to say the bishop would come round and say a few words and sprinkle some holy water, and then the ground would be consecrated like the area around a church would be, and would be come under the protection of the church, whereas the nonconformists would want to be in the non-consecrated ground. So here we have consecrated ground. Now you'll ask me when the cemetery was first opened. It was opened in 1839, but the bishop didn't come round and do his business with the holy water until 1840. So the first burials in the cemetery were non-conformists, because they didn't have to wait for him. And we can maybe see that one later, the first burial.
Are we at the furthest point of the cemetery now?
No, nowhere near. We've just moved up behind the Anglican chapel, and you've got to remember this place is 45 acres. So we're somewhere in the middle. We're nowhere near the furthest point. And the furthest point from where? It's quite a big place.
Do people get lost in here?
Yes, but we've got maps. And we're only happy to sell people a brochure with a little map in it if they'd like to buy one, so they wouldn't get lost. I've stopped us here because there's a grave that's of significance to the cemetery. This place was first opened in 1839. The reason why the cemetery came into being was that big cities like Bristol were having big problems with finding places to bury people. Well, dead people anyway. They had lots of churchyards, and for hundreds of years, over the centuries, those churchyards have coped with the turnover of the dead people. And what actually happened is that with the large numbers of people coming into the city, they couldn't cope anymore. They were burying dead closer and closer to the surface, and the churchyards themselves were becoming pretty unpleasant places to be. But the idea that you could build a purpose-built area just outside the city boundary for as a cemetery didn't start in England, it started in Europe. But this is one of the earliest ones. The earliest ones in the UK were in the London area. Bristol joined in the 1830s, and it was a group of, shall we say, astute businessmen who got together and put up the funds to buy the land and to create this cemetery. Now, in order to do that, they appointed an architect called Charles Underwood. And Charles had the idea of building it in the style of a kind of a Greek necropolis. And you've seen some of the buildings around the place that he designed. And I've shown you the garden that he envisaged to be in between the chapels and the gates. The reason we've stopped here is that this grave is the grave of that architect, Charles Underwood, who was buried here in the 1890s, some 40 years after he finished building the place.
He's got a very simple tomb.
He has, yeah, but then the whole place is his monument, I suppose.
This is a beautiful one. It's Gothic.
That's right, yeah, it's Gothic style.
With shields and little medallions.
Yeah, it's one of the listed tombs in the cemetery, and you can see those big L's on the shields, and that's for the name of the Lucas family. And Thomas Lucas was an alderman of Bristol. Obviously he had a bit of money because that must have cost quite a bit to put together. When it was new, it would have been shiny white because it's made of marble. Now it's all grey and covered in ivy. But you can imagine what sort of impact it would have had when it was first there.
This is an interesting tomb. It's a cross.
Yeah, it's a cross with a load of pine cones at its base. Now, obviously they weren't there when this tomb was put there. They've only arrived there recently, but the story behind them is that this is the tomb of a chap called John Avery Jones. And he was one of a large number of people in the cemetery, or buried in the cemetery, who were mayors of Bristol. This man was a mayor of Bristol, and he lived up in Pembroke Road. Now, a few months ago, the now owners of that house where he lived had to have a tree removed because it had grown to the extent that it was actually in danger of falling down. But before they had it cut down, they took some of the pine cones, or perhaps they took them after it had been cut down, and they placed it on the grave here of John Avery Jones. And it's a nice touch because he would have been the man who planted that tree when it was first there.
Well, we're coming down a little path to a very impressive monument, and this is listed. What's this one?
Well, this is the biggest obelisk in the cemetery. You can see it's in the midst of being repaired at the moment. It's a monument to various members of the Melsom family who were businessmen in Bristol. You can see that the damage is mainly around the base of the tomb. And what happened is that someone, when the place was in a really bad state some years ago, decided that they wanted to get hold of the decorative pieces around the bottom of the monument, and they proceeded to remove them. Luckily, they were caught in the middle of doing it, and we've still got those pieces which we're going to replace now.
When did obelisks become fashionable?
Well, they became fashionable gradually during the Victorian period. What happened was that after Lord Nelson had a go at Napoleon and was successful, the Egyptian government were really chuffed, and they gave an obelisk to England as a sort of a gift. Of course, one had already been taken by Napoleon and stuck up in the middle of Paris, so it was only right that London should have one as well. But it took us about 60 years to get it over here and put up and on the embankment, and now it's known as Cleopatra's Needle. But during that time, people became more familiar with them, and they started to use them in cemeteries. They were good alternatives to crosses, for example, for people who were, say, High Church of England, but wanted to make it clear that they weren't Catholics. So by not having a cross and having an obelisk, that would be a good way of doing that.
was Anthony there, chatting to Dave Napier.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Studio now, as advertised, is Whitebeard. Good evening.
Good evening, mate.
Now tell us a little bit. We've got Halloween coming up, and are you a bit of a fan of some knowledge about this, Mrs. Bex?
I've always had an interest in the English folklore traditions and been sort of like studying them on a sort of enthusiastic amateur level for 40 odd years. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, I mean, a lot of my friends kind of tend to say, but Halloween's just sort of, it's just this American thing, you know, it's just like, it comes over from America, and now we all have to celebrate it, and you have to buy all the Halloween stuff in Asda, etc.
As a commercial money-making excuse for a holiday, It is of American origin.
Right.
The whole point of buying plastic pumpkins and plastic witch masks and that is purely straight out of the US of A. But the original traditions of Halloween go back to pre-Roman times. There, it's from an ancient Celtic, from the ancient Celtic religion. It's the comes from Samhain, which is the Celtic New Year's Eve. You know, on the Samhain festival, the old year died.
Yeah,
and the new year was reborn.
Right. Okay.
It also ties in with the almost like the harvest festival tradition, where you gather your crops in. And you get all your mates together, and you have a big party to celebrate the death of the old year, beginning of the new.
Right.
And it also ties in with almost like a kind of festival, very similar to the Mexican Day of the Dead.
Okay.
Whereas, like, because in the ancient Celtic traditions and a lot of paganistic traditions from Northern Europe, there wasn't any of this concept of good and evil, heaven and hell. You were born. And when you died, your spirit went back to the landscape in which you lived.
Mm.
So therefore, the landscape, similar to what the Australian Aborigines believe, is part of the collective soul of the people. So therefore, when you invited your brother and his brother-in-law and your uncle and them from down the road down to your place for your Samhain knees up, you know, you invited the dead as well. Because they were there, they're part of the landscape, they will come. Flit around on the edge and watch you having a good time, effectively.
Okay.
So that's the core tradition of the festival.
Yeah. Right, it's usually seen as sort of more of a Christian kind of celebration. So how's that kind of got mixed up?
Well, when Christianity started spreading into Northern Europe, well, across the globe from its base in the Roman world, obviously, if you want to convert a local people, it's far easier to adapt an existing festival for your own ends.
Right.
Than it is to kind of say, right, stop doing what you've been doing for the last 3,000 years. This is what we're going to do new. It's a good case of, right, instead of the winter solstice, we'll celebrate the birth of Jesus and have Christmas. Instead of your end of the old year, beginning of the new, Samhain, we'll call it, the Eve of All Hallows, and on Hallows Day, or All Saints Day, we shall celebrate the glorious, sort of like, martyred saints.
Right, and then try and point out how they're similar.
Yeah, basically that's it. And it's kind of, some more hardline pagans will turn around and say it's hijacking tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Most kind of people turn around and say, that's the way things go, it's the easiest way of doing things.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, so from that point on, from sort of like round about maybe 700 AD in the Roman world. Well, say another Roman Empire went there by then, but from that point on, the Roman Catholic world, and then maybe from sort of like round about 300 years later in the Northern Europe, Northern European tradition, it became more of the Christian Halloween or Hallows Day or All Saints Day kind of tradition, adapting a lot of the concepts and ideas from the ancient Celtic religion.
So what is the Christian Halloween really celebrating? I mean, we know kind of what Easter and Christmas is all revolving around the life of Jesus. What is Halloween about?
Well, under Christian tradition, I mean, there are probably Christians that will probably can explain this better than I can. But basically, All Saints Day, which we've now deemed as November 1st,
yeah,
is kind of like a tradition where you celebrate the lives of the saints and the holy.
Mm.
Therefore, Halloween is where you get together in the kind of priest thing, so therefore it's the ones that haven't achieved holiness are the ones that are kind of creeping out the woodwork, and it's kind of, oh, you must follow the pagan ways because they're the evil spirits that's come to get you. You know, you've got to gather. And originally it was like in the medieval tradition, Christians would then gather together and the sort of like the carved turnips or the pumpkins as they have now in America, but in European tradition it was carved turnips that were stuck on the windowsill as kind of symbolic of Great Uncle Fred from 500 years ago, then became a guard against the evil demon lurking outside the door.
Okay, so some of the bad ones who might want, which should be celebrated as well, would try and kind of gate crash the All Saints.
Under the tradition, under the Christian tradition, yes.
Yeah. And so these, and then he's trying to ward off the bad ones. So okay, right. So how has celebrating it changed? I mean, how far back are we talking about, you know, carving the pumpkins and all the rest of it? And what happened before then?
Well, the earliest sort of mention of Halloween traditions basically comes from Julius Caesar and a few other Roman writers sort of like round about between sort of like 75 to sort of like 52 BC when they're trying to subjugate Gaul, his first campaigns against the British Isles.
Yeah.
And he mentions about the Samhain festival. That's where the issue of the legend of the Wicker Man comes from.
Right.
And all these evil Gauls that are kind of burning children in Wicker Men and copulating round roaring fires, etc.
Right.
You know, this is the evil we've got to stamp out. And when you realise that the Celtic civilization, as such, was going for at least 1,500 years before the Romans started interfering. It goes, you're looking at maybe going back to sort of like at least 1,500, maybe 2,000 BC, at least. And beyond then, you're lost in the mist of time, yeah?
Yeah.
So no one really knows how it developed, yeah?
Do sort of Satanists celebrate Halloween for the opposite reason? You know, sort of, hooray, it's Halloween, let's celebrate all the evil spirits.
Yeah, I suppose they do. I mean, I don't know that many. I do know one or two Satanists, but they're more follow the modern Anthony Levayan's idea of Satanism, which is kind of not too dissimilar from Christianity, perversely. But traditionally, I suppose, you've got the rebel factor in any society.
Yeah.
The powers that be, church says this, therefore we must do the opposite. And, you know, which I think is a bit strange because Satan is a Christian deity. Or as such, it's the fallen angel. It's a very Christian idea.
Mm.
And all Satanism really is the flip side of Christianity, if you ask me. Nothing to do with the traditional
pagan background. So they're kind of defining themselves by what they're not rather than what they are.
Yes, basically, yeah. I mean, to me, Satanism is a little bit on the weird side, but it must not be confused with paganism or Wicca or modern neo-paganism, which is something completely different.
Okay. I'll just pick you up a little bit. You said there was a kind of Satanism which is similar to Christianity. So can you explain that again?
The modern anti-Levayan Satanism. Anthony Levay is a Satanist writer. His most famous book is The Satanic Bible.
Right.
Is an American, I think he might be Canadian, but is a kind of cult guru figure.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's still alive. And basically, he redefined Satanism as kind of, basically as the flip side of Christianity, but without a God figure, where Satan, you become the God yourself kind of thing. And
so
Satan,
kind of like a perverse atheism, sort of. Badly defined atheism.
Yes, but then he drapes it with the trappings of Christianity. Right. He has his 10 satanic commandments, which, funny enough, some of which are thou shalt not kill, unless thou hast good reason, don't steal, etc., you know, honour each other, etc.
I think you'd be quite good at sort of becoming your own god, because you've got to look like him anyway. You've got to, you know, the hair and the big beard and...
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to go into my own personal spiritual beliefs here, but, I do believe that... you know, people find God in their own way.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, that's totally fair enough, yeah. What will you be doing for Halloween, most importantly?
Well, funny enough, one of our best friends is Stag Night, so I'll probably be out somewhere in Bristol drinking copious amounts of cider.
Excellent. What are your favourite kinds of cider? It's not on topic, but it's a question I feel I have to ask.
I do like Black Rat, the Bath Ale's 8% rough. That's a lovely cider.
Rough kind of make you kind of not advertising it terribly well there.
No, it's a still cloudy cider. Okay. It's called rough because it's not been filtered. Still get the kind of lot of misty apple pulp in it.
Yeah.
It's a traditional cider as opposed to one of these chemically natchy, you know.
Okay, well, Whitebeard, thank you very much for coming in.
No problem.
And best
thank
of luck you, in your adventures.
Thank you.
Well, time for our Book of the Week, read by Malcolm Grieve. We've decided to knock The Innkeeper's Diary on the head for a little while. The initial culture shock of John Fothergill running a pub has kind of petered out into more sort of tales of everyday life. So it's become slightly less interesting. And now for the autumn and Halloween, we've got an M.R. James story this week. Malcolm will be reading There Was a Man Dwelt by a Churchyard.
There Was a Man Dwelt by a Churchyard by M.R. James. There was a man dwelt by a churchyard. This, you know, is the beginning of the story about sprites and goblins, which Mamilius, the best child in Shakespeare, was telling his mother, the queen, and the court ladies, when the king came in with his guards and hurried her off to prison. There is no more of the story. Mamilius died soon after without having a chance of finishing it. Now, what was it going to have been? Shakespeare knew, no doubt, and I will be bold to say that I do. It was not going to be a new story. It was to be one which you have most likely heard, and even told. Everybody may set it in what frame he likes best. This is mine. There was a man dwelt by a churchyard. His house had a lower story of stone and an upper one of timber. The front windows looked out on the street, and the back ones on the churchyard. It had once belonged to the parish priest, but, this was Queen Elizabeth's days, the priest was a married man and wanted more room. Besides, his wife disliked seeing the churchyard at night out of her bedroom window. She said she saw, but never mind what she said. Anyhow, she gave her husband no peace till he agreed to move to a larger house in the village street, and the old one was taken by John Poole, who was a widower and lived there alone. He was an elderly man who kept very much to himself, and people said he was something of a miser. It was very likely true. He was morbid in other ways, certainly. In those days, it was common to bury people at night and by torchlight, and it was noticed that whenever a funeral was toward, John Poole was always at his window, either on the ground floor or upstairs, according as he could get the better view from one or the other. There came a night when an old woman was to be buried. She was fairly well to do, but she was not liked in that place. The usual thing was said of her that she was no Christian, and that on such nights as Midsummer's Eve and All Hallows she was not to be found in her house. She was red-eyed and dreadful to look at, and no beggar ever knocked at her door. Yet when she died, she left a purse of money to the church. There was no storm on the night of her burial. It was fair and calm. But there was some difficulty about getting bearers and men to carry the torches, in spite of the fact that she had left larger fees than common for such as did that work. She was buried in woollen, without a coffin. No one was there but those who were actually needed, and John Poole, watching from his window. Just before the grave was filled in, the parson stooped down and cast something upon the body, something that clinked, and in a low voice he said words that sounded like, "Thy money perish with thee." Then he walked quickly away, and so did the other men, leaving only one torchbearer to light the sexton and his boy while they shovelled the earth in. They made no very neat job of it, and next day, which was a Sunday, the churchgoers were rather sharp with the sexton, saying it was the untidiest grave in the yard. And indeed, when he came to look at it himself, he thought it was worse than he had left it. Meanwhile, John Poole went about with a curious air, half exulting, as it were, and half nervous. More than once he spent an evening at the inn, which was clean contrary to his usual habit, and to those who fell in to talk with him, he hinted that he'd come into a little bit of money, and was looking out for a somewhat better house.
"Well, I don't wonder," said the smith one night. "I shouldn't care for that place of yours. I should be fancying things all night."
The landlord asked him what sort of things.
"Well, maybe somebody climbing up to the chamber window, or the like of that," said the smith. "I don't know. Old Mother Wilkins that was buried a week ago today, eh?"
"Come, I think you might consider a person's feelings," said the landlord. "It ain't so pleasant for Master Poole, now, is it?"
"Master Poole don't mind," said the smith. "He's been there long enough to know.
I only says it wouldn't be my choice. What with the passing bell, and the torches when there's a burial, and all them graves lying so quiet when there's no one about.
Only they say there's lights.
So have you ever seen no lights, Master Poole?"
"No, I don't ever see no lights," said Master Poole sulkily, and called for another drink, and went home late.
That night, as he lay in his bed upstairs, a moaning wind began to play about the house, and he could not go to sleep. He got up and crossed the room to a little cupboard in the wall. He took out of it something that clinked, and put it in the breast of his bedgown. Then he went to the window and looked out into the churchyard. Have you ever seen an old brass in a church of a figure of a person in a shroud? It is bunched together at the top of the head in a curious way. Something like that was sticking up out of the earth in a spot of the churchyard which John Poole knew very well. He darted into his bed and lay there very still indeed. Presently, something made a very faint rattling at the casement. With a dreadful reluctance, John Poole turned his eyes that way. Alas! Between him and the moonlight was the black outline of the curious bunched head. Then there was a figure in the room. Dry earth rattled on the floor. A low, cracked voice said, "Where is it?" And steps went hither and thither, faltering steps as of one walking with difficulty. It could be seen now and again, peering into corners, stooping to look under chairs. Finally, it could be heard fumbling at the doors of the cupboard in the wall, throwing them open. There was a scratching of long nails in the empty shelves. The figure whipped round, stood for an instant at the side of the bed, raised its arms, and with a hoarse scream of, "You've got it!" At this point, Prince Mamilius flung himself with a loud yell upon the youngest of the court ladies present, who responded with an equally piercing cry. He was instantly seized upon by Queen Hermione, who, repressing an inclination to laugh, shook and slapped him very severely. Much flushed, and rather inclined to cry, he was about to be sent to bed. But on the intercession of his victim, who had now recovered from the shock, he was eventually permitted to remain until his usual hour for retiring, by which time he too had so far recovered as to assert, in bidding good night to the company, that he knew another story quite three times as dreadful as that one, and would tell it on the first opportunity that offered.
That was Malcolm Grieve reading us There Was a Man Dwelt by a Churchyard by M.R. James.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Jess Marks is here with us for another edition of What's On. I see you're proudly donning your Skindred t-shirts today. Yeah, both me and Jeff went to see Skindred when they were playing a couple of weeks ago. What did you think?
Oh, it was awesome. Really enjoyed it.
Excellent. What's going on?
Okay, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect to Radio. Starting with Thursday, November the 5th, Amrita Lynch will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £2 in advance and £3 on the door. Also on 5th of November, Magnum will be performing with support from Awake at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £16.50 in advance. Moving to Friday, November the 6th, Hooper will be performing at the Tunnels, which is at Bristol and Exeter Mews, near to Templemead Station in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Helloween. This group formed in Germany in 1984, and to date have released 12 albums. This is from the Master of the Rings album, which was released in 1994, and is a track titled Perfect Gentleman. Helloween with Perfect Gentleman from the Master of the Rings album. For more information, you can check out www.helloween.org. Keeping with Friday, November the 6th, the Bon Jovi Experience will be performed at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance. On Saturday, 7th of November, Cable Co. will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 8th of November, Sisters with Voices will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Bristol. Expect performances from Beth Rowley, Caroline Tarbuck, Emily Breeze, Katie Brooks and many more. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and tickets are available from the venue for £10 each. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. Our Tony Gosling has been doing his own little bit of research on Halloween. This is a modern manifestation of one of the four pre-Christian fire festivals. The autumn equinox is on or around the 1st of November, and it used to be previously known as Shanhaun. The fire festivals took place at the solstices, where the sun arcs to its highest and lowest points in the sky, as well as the equinoxes, the halfway point. Spring equinox, May the 1st, for example, was the ancient Beltane, or what is known in Germany as the Walpurgis night. Anyway, these pagan festivals were, to a certain extent, Christianized, as Tony Gosling found out when he talked to the Reverend Jeff Earle, who is the vicar of St. Peter's in Weston-super-Mare.
I'm Jeff Eales. I am president of Churches Together in Weston-super-Mare. On the surface, I suppose Halloween's a bit of fun, a bit of harmless fun, but on deeper things, it's just encouraging our children to say, yeah, it's okay to go banging on people's doors and demanding treats with menaces and perhaps dress up as a ghost or whatever and dabble with things that we don't know enough about, so the dangerous things that when the children grow up and they start playing about with Ouija boards and tarot cards and what have you, they're getting into very dangerous territory there.
Surely it's just a bit of harmless fun, and the children like to be able to go out and feel like they're able, they have a bit more license on Halloween to have fun.
Yeah, that's the way the children see it, and of course they're so vulnerable, aren't they? You know, harmless fun, yeah, but when they grow up and they think, well, we did that was okay, we didn't come to any harm, let's try something else, and that leads to, as I say, things like occult and Ouija boards and things which I just think we don't know sufficient about. The good book tells us that God doesn't want us to get involved with these things, because I believe in a God who cares genuinely for us, who knows that the best place for us spiritually is to be close to Him and to obey His laws rather than to mess about with things which are perhaps of His enemy.
Do you know anything about the sort of original roots of Halloween? Whereabouts it come from?
Well, I think it actually comes from here, doesn't it? And it went over to America. And this is, I think it's also important for me to point out that, you know, this isn't a witch hunt, literally. You know, we're not after witches and pagans and things. I respect their beliefs, even though I don't particularly agree with them. It's just what the Americans have done to the thing, really, and the commercialism and the daft stuff that goes on now. I'm sure even the witches and the pagans cringe at some of the stuff that goes on Halloween night now.
Don't you think that the gods are a little bit out of fashion these days, though?
No, I think that God's right there with it, and he's always leading. I'm a great believer in conscience, and I believe that the Holy Spirit has a strong hand in your conscience, and when you do something wrong, God's just kind of warning you. It's a warning sign, really. This is dangerous territory.
Now, if we go to many shops and supermarkets and things, we're seeing a lot of Halloween gear in there. I mean, you're really going to come across as a bit of a party pooper, aren't you?
I'm sure we are. I need to point out, really, that this event that we're doing on October 31st is not an anti-Halloween, but an alternative to it, and a chance to show that Christians are not party poopers. We're ready to have a jolly good time. You know, we're going to have fireworks and fancy dress and candy floss and hot dogs. We can have fun. We will have fun. We're not party poopers. We're just being cautious in terms of, spiritually cautious, so that we're not leading our children astray.
In an age where many people simply don't know their neighbours or talk to their neighbours, isn't there something positive, though, in Halloween, with children kind of going along and knocking on the doors of people in their local district?
I think there's always a danger, particularly for the older people who are afraid to open their doors on the nicest of nights on Halloween, are just terrified in their homes, and I don't think that's good for community spirit at all.
So what exactly will you be doing here in Weston?
we have a night of 1100 lights. That is to mark 1100 years of Bath and Wells Diocese, the light of Christ in Bath and Wells. 1100 years is a long time, and we're hoping to have at least 1100 people with lanterns, torches, whatever, to bring their lights, to have fun together, as I say, playing party games, fancy dress competition, there's a balloon race, there's, I think there's a Nintendo or something up for grabs for the balloon that goes the furthest. And then we will then have a spiritual moment, shall we say, a moment of silent reflection around a cross of 1100 lights, or more, hopefully. And then the whole thing ends up with a great big firework display. The whole thing's free. You might have to pay for your refreshments, but other than that, it's a jolly good night, and as I say, a fantastic alternative. Not an anti-Halloween, but an alternative to Halloween.
So down in Weston, people have got a choice. And would you like to see the same sort of thing happening in other parts of the country? And does it happen elsewhere?
I've no idea if it does, but I'd love it to. And I'd love churches together in their various towns to get together and make that happen. I'd love it.
Reverend Jeff Earl there, the parish vicar of St. Peter's in Weston-super-Mare, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling about this year's Christianised version of Halloween, taking place in Weston this year. Now we have some music by Spinal Tap, and this is Saucy Jack.
You're a naughty one, Saucy Jack, you're a haughty one. Saucy Jack, when the street lamp's gaslight flicker then fail, then you see the last light glinting off the entrails. Oh, naughty, 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 you're a sneaky one. A Saucy Jack, you're a cheeky one. Saucy Jack, first the horse says, go now, fancy a squeeze. Next you will be shoving her down the hole to Hades. Oh, naughty, naughty, naughty. The scourge of London Town. There'll be no rest till you are a guest of the clown.
Naughty, naughty, naughty.
You're a foolish one, Saucy Jack, not a foolish one. Saucy Jack, though the peelers track you early and late, slipping out the back you counter with a checkmate.
Oh, naughty, 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 naughty.
Well, that's the end of this week's Dialect Radio Show, courtesy of the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here in the city centre. Our features were brought to us by Dialect Radio reporters Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, both Aries. Malcolm Reddis There Was a Man Dwelt by Churchyard by M.R. James, and thank you to our studio guests Judy and also Whitebeard. The What Song was presented by Jeff Sparks, who is also an Aries. Interesting. Johnny Royden's the studio engineer, and he's a Virgo. And I've been John Peters Cullen, a Cancerian. This week's show was produced by Jeff Sparks, and you can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join the Dialect team, you can always send us an email, bristolradiocoop, that's one word, at hotmail.co.uk. And if you want to join, I mean, you don't sort of have to feel pressurised into being a sort of radio buff. You just turn up, watch what we do, and sort of see what you feel you can contribute. It's goodbye from all here at Dialect Radio. It's goodbye, and take care of yourselves. Until next week, take care.